Chapter 11. The Black Proletariat in Mississippi and Louisiana. Howe and two other states with black majorities, enfranchised labor, led by educated men and groups of their own blood, sought so to guide the state as to raise the worker to comfort and safety, and failed before a land monopoly, the new power of imported capital, and organized force and fraud. Mississippi has been called a peculiarly typical state in which to study Reconstruction, but this should be modified. In direct contrast to South Carolina, Mississippi was the place where, first and last, Negroes were largely deprived of any opportunity for land ownership. The great Black Belt plantations on the Mississippi had hardly been disturbed by war. The barons ruling there, who had dictated the policy of the state, were to the last degree reactionary, because they entirely misconceived the results of the war. They were determined not to recognize even the abolition of slavery, and as for establishing peasant proprietors on their land or granting even civil rights, they were adamant. To the proposition of political rights for Negroes, they simply would not listen for a moment. Mississippi was in all respects a curious state. It was the center of a commercialized cotton kingdom. The graciousness and ease of the plantation system had scarcely taken root there. Mississippi plantations were designed to raise a profitable cotton crop and not to entertain visitors. Here and there, the more pretentious slave manor flourished, but on the whole, the level of the state in civilization and culture was distinctly below that of Virginia and South Carolina and smacked more of the undisciplined frontier. In this state, there were, in 1860, 353,899 white people, and 437,404 Negroes, of whom less than 1,000 were free. The population had only been a few thousand at the beginning of the century, and small in 1820. Then, from 1840 on, the Cotton Kingdom spread over Mississippi, greatly increasing its population. The result was that after the war, there was in this state a group of planters whose great plantations dominated the rich Black Belt. From Memphis to the Gulf were a succession of counties with 60% or more of black population, while on the poor lands of the Northeast and Southeast were the poor whites. The planters had always dominated the state in its political and economic aspects, and it was suddenly required after the war that this state should not only assimilate a voting population of nearly 450,000 former slaves, but also that the mass of poor whites should have a political significance which they had never had before. It was a project at which Mississippi quailed. Sterling Price prayed, "To God that my fears for the future of the South may never be realized, but when the right is given to the Negro to bring suit, testify before the courts, and vote in elections, you all had better be in Mexico." Mississippi had a bad financial reputation long before the Civil War. Reconstruction actually improved this. In 1839, less than one-tenth of the money collected from fines and forfeitures by the sheriffs and clerks throughout the state ever reached the treasury. In 1840, the Senate Journal had the names of 26 tax collectors who were defaulters to an average amount of $1,000 each. In 1858, the auditor of the state was a defaulter for $54,000. The endowment of Jefferson College, valued at $248,748, disappeared without record, and the college had to be closed. The money realized from the 16th Section Fund, donated to schools by the Congress of the United States, was lost or embezzled to the amount of $1,500,000. The Mississippi Union Bank sold bonds to the amount of $5 million and later repudiated the debt. The effect of war on property in the state was marked. The assessed valuation of Mississippi property in 1860 was over $500 million, subtracting $218 million as the value of the slaves. We have $291,472,912. This was reduced in 1870 to $177,278,890. The whole industrial system was upset, and the cotton crop, which was 1,200,000 bales in 1860, was in 1870 only 565,000 bales. Naturally, these planter capitalists proposed to protect themselves from further loss by dominating the labor of their former slaves and getting their work as cheaply as possible with the least outlay of capital and selling their crops at prevailing high prices. William L. Sharkey, former Chief Justice of the state, was appointed Provisional Governor June 15, 1865, and the state held a constitutional convention the same year, the first to be held in the South under the Johnson Plan. The governor complained that there was an unprecedented amount of lawlessness in the state. The convention consisted of 100 delegates, most of them representing former Whigs, largely opposed to the secession of 1861. This convention recognized slavery as abolished, but did not wish to assume responsibility for whatever honor they may be in abolishing it. An ordinance, therefore, was passed, declaring that slavery had been abolished by the United States and that hereafter it should not exist in the state. Further concessions to the Negro were fought. The Negroes of the state met October 7th and protested to Congress, expressing fear lest they be re-enslaved. President Johnson wrote to Governor Sharkey suggesting that Negroes of education and property be given the right to vote so as to forestall the radicals in the North. Johnson pointed out that such a grant would completely disarm the adversary, the radical Republicans in Congress. The suggestion did not receive any attention whatever from the convention. It is highly probable that the unanimous sentiment of the convention was against the idea of political rights for the Negro in any form. But a whole arsenal of reasons against enfranchisement was already prepared. Most of them started from the assumption of a general Negro franchise and consequent Negro domination. The intelligent freedman was considered but a drop in the bucket. It was argued that this is a white man's government, and that in the sight of God and the light of reason, a Negro suffrage was impossible. The real fight in the convention was on the subsidiary question as to whether Negro testimony would be allowed in court, and it was on this question that the campaign for electing a governor and a legislature turned. It was remarkable that throughout the South, far from envisaging Negro suffrage for a moment, the states fought first to see how few civil rights must be granted Negroes, and this gradually boiled down to the momentous question as to whether a Negro could be allowed to testify against a white man in court. The election took place October 2, 1865, and Humphreys, a general in the Confederate Army, was elected governor by the party opposed to letting Negroes testify in court, which also secured a majority of the members of the legislature. This defeated Sharkey's candidacy for the United States Senate. Humphreys had received no pardon from the president when elected, but received one afterward. Sharkey notified the president that a governor and legislature had been elected, but the president made him retain his powers and warned him that the legislature must accept the 13th Amendment and a code for the protection of Negroes. There was continued friction between the military and civil authorities, and the president allowed the writ of habeas corpus to remain suspended. Anarchy must, in any case, be prevented. The presence of Negro troops in the state caused bitter complaint. On January 5, 1866, there were 8,784 Negro troops and 338 Negro officers. The president promised to remove them as soon as possible. Sharkey declared that they encouraged the belief among Negroes that lands were going to be distributed among them. By the 20th of May, 1866, all black troops had been mustered out and removed from Mississippi. The legislature then proceeded to adopt the celebrated Black Code of 1865 and completed the set of laws by reenacting all the penal and criminal laws applying to slaves, except so far as the mode and manner and trial of punishment has been ordained by law. The North was incensed, and the Chicago Tribune said that the North would convert Mississippi into a frog pond before they will allow any such laws to touch 1 foot of soil in which the bones of our soldiers sleep. Back of this sentiment was the conviction that Mississippi, whose political population for congressional apportionment was 616,040 in 1860, would now be increased to 900,000, and this new power was going to be arrayed against Northern industry, thrift, and power. The whole reactionary course of Mississippi helped the abolition democracy in the North. General Ord assumed command in Mississippi in March 1867, and on April 15th, he began to register the new electorate, colored and white. Among Ord's appointees was Isaiah T. Montgomery, formerly a slave of Jefferson Davis. He was made a justice of the peace and was perhaps the first Negro in the state to hold public office. Ord appointed a number of civil officials and was compelled practically to nullify the Black Code by military order. The result of the registration showed the white people that, contrary to their firm and happy belief, the Negro was not becoming extinct. 46,636 white voters registered, and 60,137 Negroes. This showed the political situation plainly. In 1867, the cotton crop was almost a total failure on account of weather conditions and other reasons. Ord issued an order requiring investigation of charges against landholders of driving off freedmen in order to prevent paying back wages. There was a great deal of theft of cotton and horses. Later, the abundant crop of 1868 induced Mississippi to begin to believe in free labor. At Christmas 1867, there had been widespread rumor of a Negro insurrection due to the idea that land was going to be distributed among them. Humphreys, then governor, issued a proclamation reciting the apprehensions of combinations or conspiracies formed among the blacks to seize the lands unless Congress should arrange a plan to distribution by January 1st. Ord told General Gillem, commander in the subdistrict of Mississippi, that Congress was not going to seize the lands of planters, but that the governor had already plenty of land in Mississippi for freedmen and that they could settle on it when they chose to do so. The election was set for the first Tuesday in November 1867. Negroes were given representation among the election officials. This brought bitter protest. "We hoped this shameful humiliation would be spared our people, at least until the freedmen of Mississippi decide whether they will submit to Negro equality at the ballot box or elsewhere." General Ord has heretofore exhibited a wisdom in his administration which has been highly approved by the people, but we doubt not the lovers of peace throughout the country will condemn the order as injudicious, if not insulting, to that race whom God has created superior to the black man, and whom no monarch can make his equal. The general commanding cannot surely have forgotten that the Negro has no political rights conferred on him by the state of Mississippi, although he is given the privilege by a corrupt and fragmentary Congress to cast a ballot in the coming farce dignified by the name of election. White Mississippi fought Reconstruction tenaciously at every step. The legislature stubbornly refused to adopt the 13th Amendment, declaring that they had already abolished slavery and that they would not consent to the second section, which gave Congress the right to enforce freedom. "Shall Mississippi ratify the 13th Amendment?" asked the Vicksburg Herald on November 9th. "We answer, no. 10,000 times, no." Then came the question as to who might register and who was to decide on the eligibility of a former Confederate. The commanding general, in accordance with Johnson's instructions, declared that the Board of Registrars had no power. He was overruled by General Grant and by the Act of Congress of July 19th. Immediately, Mississippi tried to bring the matter before the Supreme Court by seeking to enjoin President Johnson from enforcing the Reconstruction Acts. The Supreme Court refused to entertain the case on the ground that it would interfere with a coordinate branch of the government in the performance of its duties. Thereupon, another action was brought by the state of Georgia, which tried to enjoin the Secretary of War, but the court held that it was without jurisdiction. Finally, the celebrated case Ex parte McCardle was started on appeal from a military decision at Vicksburg, but Congress forestalled the case by depriving the court of jurisdiction in this particular case and others of similar character. There had been a plan for the white people to refrain from voting in 1867, a plan widespread through the other southern states. The idea was that by refraining from taking any part in this convention, the whole thing might not go by default and Reconstruction fail. But that seemed to many too much of a risk, and in its place, there came a movement on the part of some of the planters to acquiesce in the situation and to organize and plan the control of the Negro vote. In other words, certain leaders, like the editor of the Jackson Clarion, General Alcorn, and Judge Campbell, were in favor of recognizing the right of the Negroes to vote in 1868 and said that the policy of the Democrats would drive the Negroes into the Republican Party. Ex-Senator Brown agreed, and many other white leaders. The most advanced Reconstructionist was General Alcorn, who asked if it would not be wise to yield something to black suffrage and then to control the votes in the interests of such an organization of industry and society as they thought best. This was no wild scheme. The Negroes were used to subordination to the great planters. If the planters did not form an alliance with the Negroes, the planters would be threatened by the pretensions of the poor whites and possible leadership from northern white men, ex-soldiers, and investors who were largely represented in the state. It was a matter to consider carefully. In the end, Mississippi went further along this line than any other southern state and found it easier to do this because of the compulsion and intimidation that could be exercised over the Negro vote on the great plantations of the Black Belt. The so-called Black and Tan Convention met at Jackson, January 9, 1868. It was the first political organization in Mississippi with colored representatives. There were in all 100 delegates, of whom 17 were colored, although 32 counties had Negro majorities. There were 29 native white Republicans and 20 or more northern Republicans. This was interesting and characteristic. It showed, in the first place, that the Negroes were not even trying, much less succeeding, in any effort to use their numerical preponderance in order to put themselves in political power. Under strong economic pressure, the Negro voter designated white men to represent him. The large majority of the members of this convention were elected by black voters. 7 or 8 of the colored delegates were ministers. 4 of the northern Republicans had lived in the South before the war, and 2 had served in the Confederate Army. It characterizes the times to know that 5 of the members, afterward, met violent deaths. Members were paid $10 a day in depreciated scrip, worth 65 to 70 cents on a dollar, making their pay about equal to the convention of 1865. During the organization of the convention, it was moved that the word colored be added to the name of each Negro delegate. Thereupon, the Reverend James Lynch, a colored man, afterward Secretary of State, moved to amend it so that the color of each delegate's hair should be added also. There was here, as in South Carolina, the same charge against this convention and against succeeding legislatures that they did not sufficiently represent wealth. They represented poverty, and the majority of the members, white and black, were not taxpayers. They represented labor and were voting and working as far as they intelligently could to improve their condition and not to increase the profits of the hirers of labor. In the convention, the colored people clung to the idea that the government intended to divide the land among them. One of the first acts of the convention was to appoint a committee of 5 to report what legislation was needed to afford relief and protection to the state and its citizens. This committee reported early in February and found an alarming amount of destitution among the laboring class. They thought that the number of the destitute was at least 30,000, and perhaps was 40,000. There was distress and suffering, which in some cases bordered on actual starvation. The commanding general, who was at the time Gillam of Tennessee, sided with the planting interests, refused to cooperate with the convention in this matter, and declared that the demand for labor exceeded the supply. In other words, labor must work for food or starve. It was reported that the Negroes were still expecting the distribution of land. Suspension of taxes imposed upon freedmen prior to January 1, 1868, was demanded, and the repudiation of all debts, contracts, and judgments incurred or made prior to April 28, 1865. The commanding general was requested to issue an order directing the restoration of property alleged to have been unlawfully taken from colored persons on the grounds that property accumulated by them in a state of slavery belonged to their masters. This the general declined to do. The commanding general was again requested, in a report signed by three colored members, to furnish from the public funds means to return slaves sold into Mississippi to their former homes, and Congress was asked to set aside, through the Freedmen's Bureau, one half of the cotton tax collected in the state. They asked the governor of the state to let Negroes share in the donations sent him for the relief of the destitute, but the governor refused, saying that it was a private gift. After this preliminary discussion, which was afterward criticized as beside the point, when in fact it was the main point, the convention turned toward making a new constitution, as they had refused to adopt the old. They framed a constitution under which Mississippi lived for 22 years. It did away with property qualifications for office or for suffrage. It forbade slavery. It provided for a mixed public school system. It forbade race distinctions in the possession and inheritance of property. It prohibited the abridgment of civil rights in travel. And in general, it was a modern instrument based on universal suffrage. A minority tried to disfranchise the mass of ignorant Negroes, and there was considerable quarreling and some fighting. Universal suffrage was adopted by a large majority, and on account of that, 12 of the white delegates resigned. Other ordinances forbade property qualification for office or educational qualification for suffrage. The civil government under Reconstruction increased the powers of the governor and made a more elaborate governmental organization and function for the state. It provided for a lieutenant governor, a state superintendent of education, and numerous other officials. Some of the counties were consolidated to form larger legislative districts. Evidently, the success of the planters in controlling the Negro vote alarmed the carpetbaggers and the poor whites, and they determined to suppress the ringleaders of the rebellion far more drastically than was required by the Reconstruction Acts. The convention consequently determined to deny the right to vote and hold office to practically all whites who had anything to do with the rebellion, and thus the proposed constitution disfranchised perhaps 20,000 or more of the leading white citizens of the state. This has been represented as petty jealousy and desire for vengeance on the part of the carpetbaggers. It was more than this. It was an attempt to end the oligarchy of landlords who still advocated slavery and the rule of wealth. After sitting 115 days, the convention adjourned and submitted the Constitution to the people. The proceedings in this convention had undoubtedly been dominated by the wishes of the Northern men and the poor whites with the support of the Negroes. But instead of cementing the alliance, the Negroes were ignored, and when preparations were made for the campaign, were given little recognition. The chief evidence of this was failure to nominate Negroes for office. The real policy beneath this was ignoring the plight of Negro labor, and making the Republican Party chiefly the mouthpiece of the new Northern capital. The opposition organized as the Democratic White Men's Party of Mississippi and declared that the Republicans were trying to degrade the Caucasian race. The provision for a mixed school system particularly came in for widespread criticism. Meantime, Humphreys was removed as governor on account of opposition to the Reconstruction Acts, and General Adelbert Ames appointed acting governor. Humphreys refused to give up and was removed by the soldiers. But reaction was not beaten. The vote of the Black Belt was cast largely under the dictation of the landholders and hirers of black labor. The result of the election was a surprise. 56,231 votes were cast for the Constitution. 63,860 were cast against it, and Humphreys had been re-elected governor. A committee of five from the convention announced that the election had been carried by fraud and intimidation, accompanied by social proscription and threats to discharge laborers from employment. The Republicans held meetings in various counties, declaring that the late election had been the work of terrorism and fraud. On the other hand, the result of the election was to show all parties that a more sincere attempt to recognize the Negro and enable him to vote had to be made. Negroes could not be ignored. Their right to vote meant something. If they were intimidated and coerced by force and economic means, the planters would soon be back in power. Moreover, even in this election, certain leading Negroes, like John R. Lynch, had deliberately voted with the planters, and an alliance of planters and Negroes was not impossible. It would have been an alliance based partly on labor control and partly on understandings consummated between black labor leaders and white landholders. Working out from the old slavery, it might have gradually negotiated an industrial emancipation for the intelligent blacks, while using the solid black vote to keep white labor and northern capital subordinate. One group of Negroes recommended, therefore, another constitutional convention. They said they wished to cultivate kindly relations with their white friends and declared that they would support capable and honorable men even if they were former Confederates. The 40th Congress adjourned, with the question of Mississippi unsettled. Finally, in April 1869, a bill was agreed upon which directed that Mississippi was to be admitted when she adopted the 15th Amendment, and that the president was authorized to submit the Constitution as a whole, and also the same Constitution with its provisions disfranchising the bulk of Confederates left out. Gillam was removed, and General Ames, who had been acting civil governor, was made provisional governor of the state. He reported that certain men, backed by public opinion, were committing murders and outrages. Under direction of Congress, Ames removed a large number of officers and made appointments of state and local officers, including several Negroes. Among other things, he declared freedmen to be competent jurors. He said of his work at this time, "I found when I was military governor of Mississippi that a black code existed there, that Negroes had no rights, and that they were not permitted to exercise the rights of citizenship. I had given them the protection they were entitled to under the laws, and I believed I could render them great service. I felt that I had a mission to perform in their interest, and I hesitatingly consented to represent them and unite my fortune with theirs." Ames thus made a counterbid for Negro support, reversing the indifferent stand of the Mississippi Republicans. In July, President Grant issued a proclamation ordering the Constitution to be submitted for ratification November 30th. The Radical Republicans held their convention July 2nd and attempted a platform of several resolutions. These resolutions declared, "In favor of an impartial and economic administration of the government, the unrestricted right of speech to all men at all times and places, unrestrained freedom of the ballot, a system of free schools, a reform of the iniquitous and unequal system of taxation and assessments which discriminated against labor," declared that all men, without regard to race, color, or previous condition of servitude, were equal before the law, recommended removal of political disabilities as soon as the spirit of toleration now dawning upon the state should be so firmly established as to justify Congress in taking such action, declared in favor of universal amnesty, universal suffrage, and encouragement of immigration. Ex-Governor Brown and the conservatives were in favor of ratifying the Constitution without the proscriptive provisions and of accepting the 15th Amendment. They secured Judge Dent, a brother-in-law of Grant, as their candidate, thinking in that way to secure the goodwill of Grant. But Grant repudiated the party that nominated Dent. The Dent party nominated Thomas Sinclair, a colored man, for Secretary of State. The Republicans nominated General J. L. Alcorn for governor and the Reverend James Lynch, a mulatto preacher, for Secretary of State. The whole election showed the increasing political importance of the Negroes, and this undoubtedly explains the increased activity of the Ku Klux Klan in 1869. There were some riots in 3 or 4 counties. The Constitution was ratified almost unanimously, but the proscriptive sections disfranchising members of the Secession Convention and other active Confederates were defeated. The provision forbidding the loan of state funds was ratified. The first Reconstruction legislature met at Jackson, January 11, 1870. The legislature elected in 1868 had never been convened because of the defeat of the Constitution. Negro membership in the new legislature was larger than in the convention. There were 40 colored members, some of whom had been slaves before the war, but among them were some very intelligent men. Particularly, there was considerable representation of ministers. In the Senate, there were 5 colored members. Many of the wealthiest counties were represented by ex-slaves. Yet, as Lynch shows, Negroes never controlled Mississippi. No colored man in that state ever occupied a judicial position above that of Justice of the Peace, and very few aspired to that position. Of 7 state officers, only one, that of Secretary of State, was filled by a colored man until 1873, when colored men were elected to 3 of the 7 offices, Lieutenant Governor, Secretary of State, and State Superintendent of Education. Of the 2 United States Senators and the 7 members of the lower house of Congress, not more than 1 colored man occupied a seat in each house at the same time. Of the 35 members of the state Senate and of the 150 members of the House, which composed the total membership of the state legislature prior to 1874, there were never more than about 7 colored men in the Senate and 40 in the lower house. Of the 97 members that composed the Constitutional Convention of 1868, but 17 were colored men. The composition of the lower house of the state legislature that was elected in 1871 was as follows. Total membership, 115. Republicans, 66. Democrats, 49. Colored members, 38. White members, 77. White majority, 39. Of the 66 Republicans, 38 were colored, and 28 white. There was a slight increase in the colored membership as a result of the election of 1873, but the colored men never at any time had control of the state government, nor of any branch or department thereof, nor even that of any county or municipality. Out of the 72 counties in the state at that time, electing on an average 28 officers to a county, it is safe to assert that not over 5 out of 100 of such officers were colored men. The state, district, county, and municipal governments were not only in control of white men, but white men who were to the manor born, or who were known as old citizens of the state, those who had lived in the state many years before the War of the Rebellion. There was, therefore, never a time when that class of white men, known as carpetbaggers, had absolute control of state government or that of any district, county, or municipality, or any branch or department thereof. There was never, therefore, any ground for the alleged apprehension of Negro domination as a result of a free, fair, and honest election in any one of the Southern or Reconstructed states. At the same time, the Negroes were laborers, and if at any time the white and black labor vote united, property and privilege in Mississippi were bound to suffer. And on the other hand, if property controlled black labor, white labor would be as helpless as before the war. These two factors explain Reconstruction in Mississippi. The legislature ratified the 14th and 15th Amendments and elected 3 United States senators, one for the full term and 2 for unexpired terms. For the full term, Alcorn was chosen, and for 1 unexpired term, General Ames. While Hiram R. Revels, a colored minister, was chosen to fill the unexpired term of Jefferson Davis. Revels came from North Carolina and was educated in Indiana. He was a minister in Baltimore at the opening of the war and there helped to organize two colored regiments. He came south with the Freedmen's Bureau and was surprised when selected to represent the state in the Senate. He was a man of intelligence, but the Republican United States debated 3 days on his credentials. Finally, after one of Sumner's ablest speeches, he was admitted. Even after that, Philadelphia refused the use of her Academy of Music for a meeting at which he was to speak. Ames now turned over the government to Alcorn and went to the Senate. Alcorn took a firm and advanced stand. In his inaugural speech, he spoke of his attachment for Mississippi. He declared that it was the duty of the government to protect all its citizens, white and black, before the ballot box, the jury box, and public office, and to give industrial opportunity to the honest and competent without discrimination of color. He said, "In the face of memories that might have separated them from me, as the wronged from the wronger, they offered me their confidence, offered me the guardianship of their new and precious hopes, with a trustfulness whose very mention stirs my nerves with emotion. In response to that touching radiance, the most profound anxiety which I enter my office as governor of this state is that of making the colored man the equal before the law of every other man, the equal, not in dead letter, but in living fact." He had a word to say for the poor whites. "Thousands of our worthy white friends have ever remained, to a great extent, strangers to the helping hand of the state." Fortunately, Alcorn, instead of staying and finishing this job thus well outlined, had the universal Southern ambition of the day to go to the United States Senate. He was, therefore, in office only a little over a year when he went to Washington to succeed Revels. The legislature, meantime, went to work to set up the government. The part which the Negro played in this Reconstruction was as extraordinary as it was unexpected. There were far fewer Negroes of education and ability in Mississippi than in South Carolina or Louisiana, but there were a few, perhaps a bare half dozen, who gave universal and epic-making service. One of these leaders, and perhaps the best, tells of the task before them. The new administration had an important and difficult task before it. A state government had to be organized from top to bottom. A new judiciary had to be inaugurated, consisting of 3 justices of the state Supreme Court, 15 judges of the Circuit Court, and 20 Chancery Court judges, who had all to be appointed by the governor with the consent of the Senate. And, in addition, a new public school system had to be established. There was not a public school building anywhere in the state, except in a few of the larger towns, and they, with possibly a few exceptions, were greatly in need of repairs. To erect the necessary schoolhouses, and to reconstruct and repair those already in existence, so as to afford educational facilities for both races, was by no means an easy task. It necessitated a very large outlay of cash in the beginning, which resulted in a material increase in the rate of taxation for the time being, but the Constitution called for the establishment of the system, and, of course, the work had to be done. It was not only done, but it was done creditably and as economically as possible, considering the conditions of that time. That system, though slightly changed, still stands. A creditable monument to the first Republican state administration that was organized in the state of Mississippi under the Reconstruction Acts of Congress. It was also necessary to reorganize, reconstruct, and, in many instances, rebuild some of the penal and charitable institutions of the state. A new code of laws also had to be adopted to take the place of the old code and thus wipe out the black laws that had been passed by what was now known as the Johnson Legislature, and in addition, bring about other changes so as to make the laws and statutes of the state conform with the new order of things. This was no easy task, in view of the fact that a heavy increase in the rate of taxation was thus made necessary for the time being, at least. That this important task was splendidly, creditably, and economically done, no fair-minded person who is familiar with the facts will question or dispute. That the state never had before, and has never since had, a finer judiciary than that which was organized under the administration of Governor Alcorn, and which continued under the administration of Governor Ames, is an indispensable and incontrovertible fact. When the Alcorn administration took charge of the state government, the war had just come to a close. Everything was in a prostrate condition. There had been great depreciation in the value of real and personal property. The credit of the state was not very good. The rate of interest for borrowed money was high. To materially increase the bonded debt of the state was not deemed wise, yet some had to be raised in that way. To raise the balance, a higher rate of taxation had to be imposed, since the assessed valuation of the taxable property was so low. The legislature of 1871 was in session about 6 months and passed 325 acts and resolutions. The increase of citizenship and the revolution through which the state had passed called without doubt for more laws. The expenses of the legislative department were large and the session long. Yet it can hardly be said, considering the work done and the depreciated value of currency, that it was an extravagant assembly. The legislature of 1872 had John R. Lynch, a Negro, as Speaker of the House. There were 28 white and 38 colored Republicans and 49 Democrats, and it took a trip of Senator Alcorn from Washington to induce enough white Republicans to support Lynch in order to elect him. At the close of the session, however, Lynch was presented with a gold watch and chain. One motion of a prominent white Democrat, a resolution was adopted thanking him for his dignity, impartiality, and courtesy as a presiding officer. The Clarion declared his bearing in office had been so proper, and his rulings in such marked contrast to the former conduct of the ignoble whites of his party, who had been aspiring to be leaders of the blacks, that the conservatives cheerfully joined in the testimonial. Civil rights measures constituted a considerable part of the legislation between 1868 and 1876. In his inaugural address, Governor Alcorn asserted positively that so long as he was governor, all citizens, without respect to color or nativity, should be shielded by the law as with a panoply. In 1870, all laws relative to free Negroes, slaves, and mulattoes, as found in the Code of 1857, and the laws constituting the so-called Black Codes, were declared to be forever repealed. It was declared to be the true intent and meaning of the legislature to remove from the records of the state all laws which in any manner recognized any natural difference or distinction between citizens and inhabitants of the state. The legislature elected in 1873 had 37 members of the Senate, of whom 9 were colored and 9 white carpetbaggers. In the House, over 115 members, of whom 55 were colored and 60 white, including 15 carpetbaggers. This election went further than any toward a fusion of planters and Negroes, and this was only prevented by the rivalry of Alcorn and Ames. When Alcorn went to the Senate, he was succeeded by a carpetbagger, R.C. Powers. Finally, in 1873, Ames, who had been in the United States Senate, was elected governor over Alcorn, who was again candidate. With Ames, 3 colored men went to office: A.K. Davis, lieutenant governor; James Hill, secretary of state; and T.W. Cardozo, superintendent of education. B.K. Bruce had been selected for lieutenant governor, but refused, and afterward went to the Senate. This greatly disappointed Alcorn, who wished to remain in the Senate, and who, therefore, refused to escort Bruce to take the oath. Bruce had been county assessor, parish and tax collector in Bolivar County, one of the wealthiest counties in the state. Davis, the new lieutenant governor, had made a creditable record as member of the legislature, but he was not a strong man. Hill was a young, active, and aggressive, and about the average colored man in intelligence. Cardozo was capable, but not well known. As to the colored men in the legislature of 1873, Garner says, "Relative to the course of the colored members of this legislature, a prominent Democrat writes me as follows. In my opinion, if they had all been native Southern Negroes, there would have been little cause of complaint. They often wanted to vote with Democrats on non-political questions, but could not resist the party lash. The majority of whites in both parties exhibit the same weakness." The real meaning of this criticism was that the Negroes wanted to cooperate with the planters, but knew that the planters would disfranchise them at the first opportunity and only welcomed their alliance now for economic reasons. On the other hand, the Republicans were torn with factions, jealousies, and suspicions, and the Negroes did not know how far they could be trusted. With a few exceptions, the colored members took little part in the work of legislation, although some of the principal chairmanships were held by them. There were few educated men among them, and they watched only for efforts to abridge their privileges as voters and citizens. On the other hand, there were no charges of venality or bribery, and their efforts to learn were intense. They were too willing to take advice and follow leadership once their confidence had been obtained. The number of prominent planters in Mississippi who entered the Republican Party to lead the Negroes was unusually large as compared with other states. Ames immediately began a program of retrenchment in expenditures and recommended many reforms. Taxes had been increased from 1 mill on the dollar in 1869 to 14 in 1874. The credit of the state was still impaired. He recommended a cut of 25% in appropriations, and especially curtailing the bill for public printing. "The recommendations," says Garner, "do credit to the governor who made them. They do not sound like the utterance of a carpetbagger bent on peculation and plunder." There were the usual charges of extravagance against the Reconstruction government. It should, however, be said that if the testimony of Governor Ames may be followed relative to the expenses of the state government during the 2 years in which he was at its head, his was the most economical administration since 1856. With the exception of 2 years, 1861 and 1869. It was charged that the public debt of Mississippi increased from almost nothing to $20 million during the Reconstruction regime, but this was easily disproved by ex-Governor Ames, who had the figures, and the committee of Democratic legislators that sought to impeach him had to acknowledge the truth of what he said. Thus, it will be seen that the actual indebtedness of the state is but little over $500,000, and that during the 2 years of Governor Ames's administration, the state debt had been reduced from $821,292.82 on January 1, 1874, to $520,138.33 on January 1, 1876. Or a reduction of more than $300,000 in 2 years, upwards of one-third of the state debt wiped out in that time. Not only has the debt been reduced as above, but the rate of taxation for general purposes has been reduced from 7 mills in 1873 to 4 mills in 1875. It should also be said by way of explanation that the work of restoration which the government was obliged to undertake made increased expenses necessary. During the period of the war, and for several years thereafter, public buildings and state institutions were permitted to fall into decay. The State House and grounds, the Executive Mansion, the Penitentiary, the Insane Asylum, and the buildings for the blind, deaf, and dumb were in a dilapidated condition and had to be extended and repaired. A new building for the blind was purchased and fitted up. The Reconstructionists established a public school system and spent money to maintain and support it, perhaps too freely, in view of the impoverishment of the people. When they took hold, warrants were worth but 60 or 70 cents on the dollar, a fact which made the price of building materials used in the work of construction correspondingly higher. Garner admits there were no great railroad swindles and no charge of excessive debt. The only charge, which is perhaps true, was that the number of offices and agencies was needlessly increased. The one center of undoubted graft under Ames was the public printing contracts, which increased from $8,675 a year, 1867 to 1868, to sums varying from $50,000 to $127,000 in 1870 to 1875. This seems, however, to have been largely due to one white man, and it is not clear whether he was northern or southern born. Rhodes declares that few Negroes were competent to perform their duties, and that one who was sheriff of DeSoto County for 4 years could neither read nor write, and farmed out his office to a white deputy for a share of the revenue. John R. Lynch proves that this statement is absolutely false. The Reverend J.J. Evans, a colored Baptist minister and a Union soldier who held that position, gave entire satisfaction. He left office with a spotless record, accounted for every cent of the funds, and he had, as he wrote, a letter from Evans before him which showed that Evans could read and write. Mr. Lynch goes on to say that of the 72 counties of the state, not more than 12 ever had colored sheriffs, and that he knew 10 of these, and that, in point of intelligence, capacity, and honesty, the colored sheriffs would have favorably compared with the whites. When one considers that over one half of the electors had been slaves, now for the first time given a voice in government, Reconstruction in Mississippi certainly seems like a success. The Negro leaders who came to the front were in most cases admirable and honest men, and only a few were corrupt. The advance of the masses of the people was shown in the increase of marriage licenses. In 1865, licenses were issued to whites, 2,708, and to blacks, 564, while in 1870, 2,204 were issued to whites and 3,427 to blacks. In those 2 years, churches built increased from 105 to 283. A curious feud between the governor and his colored lieutenant governor began in the summer of 1874, when Governor Ames went north on his vacation. The lieutenant governor discharged certain appointees and appointed several judges. Governor Ames, upon returning, revoked these appointees. Lieutenant Governor Davis also issued a large number of pardons to persons in jail. Singularly enough, while one of the accusations in the attempted impeachment of Ames was his dismissal of Davis's judicial appointees, Davis was also removed from office in 1876. It was alleged that he had accepted a bribe for granting a pardon. On the other hand, the governor's action in revoking Davis's appointments was called by his legislature of 1876 willful, corrupt, and unlawful. It was the especial grievance of the whites that officials and voters were not taxpayers, and that a comparatively small number of the colored voters owned real estate. The most that was charged was that the number of offices and agencies with high salaries was needlessly multiplied. The break came, however, between labor and capital inside the Democratic Party. Of course, a stubborn and bitter fight for control of the Democratic organization was now on between the antagonistic and conflicting elements among the whites. It was to be a desperate struggle between former aristocrats on one side and what was known as poor whites on the other. While the aristocrats had always been the weaker in point of numbers, they had been the stronger in point of wealth, intelligence, ability, skill, and experience. As a result of their wide experience and able and skillful management, the aristocrats were successful in the preliminary struggles, as illustrated in the persons of Stevens, Gordon, Brown, and Hill of Georgia, Daniels and Lee of Virginia, Hampton and Butler of South Carolina, Lamar and Walthall of Mississippi, and Garland of Arkansas. But in the course of time, and in the neutral order of things, the poor whites were bound to win. All that was needed was a few years' tutelage and a few daring and unscrupulous leaders to prey upon their ignorance and magnify their vanity in order to bring them to a realization of the fact that their former political masters were now completely at their mercy and subject to their will.